traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. There's a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, the Insurgent Radio Network.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance, and this is Terrible Tommy right here in the bunker in north central Indiana, where it is, the sun's coming out. It's been raining last night and overcast this morning, but the sun's coming out, and I think we're going to have a pretty nice day right here on the in the fourth month and the eighth day of April. 2015 on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Yeah. Well, we got to celebrate today, boys and girls. Yep, we got to celebrate. A great thing came to my attention in the wee hours, and that is a talk by Black Radio, Mark Thompson, I think is his name, on XM Radio. And he has announced that he is giving us the weapons that we need to beat back this problem at a certain point. Yeah, he gave us the key. I've known about the key for a long time, but it wasn't going anywhere. It was small potatoes. I knew a black minister in California who was pushing reparations. But now we've got something really cooking, and the guy said it's like the going to hit like the third rail. No, it's going to hit like Mount Vesuvius erupting, because this is big stuff. And I want you to listen to this and tell me why this is not good, or this is worse is better. Very, very worse is better. And it makes me so happy I don't know what to do. So stand by.
Conference in this larger context of this renewed discussion that I'm finding is fascinating about reparations, both the Coates article that came out in the Atlantic last June, but then this other piece that happened almost by coincidence, that Don wrote this piece about the emergence of a reparations discussion in the Caribbean, and then most recently that included their support for the demand for reparations for the Caribbean. So I really wanted to put all of this stuff together tonight.
Right.
And so, Don, I wanted to just start with, if you could tell us what drove this reparations conference, and what are the objectives?
Right, right. Well, first of all, let me just give some facts about this conference coming up in April. It is being organized by the Institute of the Black World, which, as you both know, is led by its president, Dr. Ron Daniels. I am working very closely with Brother Daniels and other members of the board of the Institute of the Black World to organize this major event, which is slated for New York in April, April 9th to the 12th. The activities are going to take place in three different boroughs. We're going to start off in Manhattan, up in Harlem, with the opening rally on the night of Thursday, the 9th of April. Then we go to Queens, and we spend 2 days in business sessions at York College in Queens. And then for the final closing rally, we go to Central Brooklyn in the Bedford-Stuyvesant area. And the idea is to try to take the discussion around New York City in a period of 2 to 3 days. And participating in that discussion will be, and this is the amazing thing, we are now seeing registrations coming in via our website, the IBW's website, from all over the Caribbean, all over the United States, from the South, the West, the Midwest, the Northwest in the U.S., and from Central America and Latin America. In fact, we got a just today someone registered from Colombia wants to come to represent and speak on behalf of the Afro-Colombian community that is now taking up the issue of reparations in Colombia, in South America. We have already three people coming from Brazil who are going to represent the emerging Brazil reparations movement. And, of course, from the Caribbean itself, we are going to have representatives of each of the 13 national reparations commissions that have been established within the CARICOM area, the Caribbean community area. 13 sovereign independent nations have unanimously agreed to work towards reparations as sovereign states collectively to place a series of reparations demands on the former colonial and powers and slave-holding countries, Britain, France, Germany, the Netherlands, and even Sweden. They have come together, they came together actually in 2013 at a heads of government summit meeting in Trinidad and Tobago and established the CARICOM Reparations Commission, which is headed up by one of the leading public intellectuals in the Caribbean region today, Professor Sir Hilary Beckles, who is also going to be the new president of the University of the West Indies. But all of these countries, this is the amazing thing, for the first time in modern history, have sovereign nations, not activists like you and I, you know, not pan-Africanists, but sovereign countries headed up by prime ministers and presidents have all agreed to a unified set of demands and, in fact, a 10-point program, a 10-point plan for what they call reparatory justice for 300 years of African enslavement and for genocide against the indigenous peoples of the Caribbean region. This is an unprecedented development.
But here's my question. Why
yes.
now? These countries have been independent for years, in some
right.
cases, what, 50 years?
Right.
So,
right.
like, why now? Why,
well,
why not
I,
back in 1961?
Right. Well, I think that the impetus came out of the global economic crisis of 2008 and 2009, which impacted severely and disproportionately on the small Caribbean economies that were even before the crisis in global capitalism in 2008 were extremely vulnerable. You know, they had just come out of a period of early independence from the 60s and the 70s. They were embarking on a path towards developing their countries, and they got hit by the global economic meltdown. Their economies took a beating, and they then began to recognize that the only that they were not responsible initially for this global meltdown. That this crisis took place in the heart of the most developed capitalist countries in the world, Europe and the United States, right? And but yet they, small vulnerable countries that were once colonies of these mighty imperialist powers, were suffering the most. And so they figured, well, look, one way to try to recoup the momentum that we had begun to develop in the early part of this century towards development, which stalled, which just literally fell off of a cliff in 2008, was to demand reparations, was to demand payback, so to speak, for the centuries of plunder and rape of African labor that have been brought from the continent to the Caribbean region and had never been compensated. You know, so I think that was the modern impetus for the rejuvenation, you might say, of a reparations movement. Now, of course, you know, reparations has been around for a long time in the United States, in Africa, among Pan-Africanists around the world. But what the Caribbean nations did in 2008 was to spark, by their bold and audacious declaration, was to spark a new interest in the whole question of reparations throughout the world. And that's why you're seeing that this is not just a question that is limited to the Caribbean region anymore. You know, this, what the Caribbean has done, in fact, has inspired and motivated a rebirth of the reparations idea throughout the Americas.
Now, traditionally, at least in the United States, the principal organization, although certainly not the only organization, that's been raising this among African Americans has been
NCOBRA.
Right.
NCOBRA is going to be, they're going to be very much involved in the conference that we are planning for April in New York. In fact, NCOBRA is going to have a representative, has already appointed a representative, Brother Cam Howard out of Chicago, well-known among reparations activists in the United States, to be a member of a National African American Reparations Commission, which is going to be launched at the same time that the conference is being held in New York. And this will be a 15-person body modeled very similarly to the Reparations Commissions coming out of the Caribbean region. Several prominent activists and activist scholars from across the United States, people like Dr. Julian Malveaux, Dr. Conrad Roro, and many others have agreed to sit on this Reparations Commission, which will be formally launched. And once it is launched in New York, in the months after that, the commission will go around the country and will engage African American communities in town hall meetings to get the people's input and recommendations as to how to formulate a 10-point plan, a 10-point African American plan for reparations. Now, you know, brothers, listen, the reparations concept is enjoying some currency at the moment, not only in the U.S., but even in Europe. It's very interestingly that the Russian parliament 2 weeks ago passed a unanimous resolution calling for the establishment of a task force, a Russian task force, to begin preparing a series of demands for reparations from Germany, right, for the damage that that Germany inflicted on the Soviet Union during World War II. I mean, this is unbelievable. So then a week after that, the new Greek government, the new progressive government in Greece, also announced that they were issuing a set of reparations demands to Germany for war crimes against the Greek people during World War II. Right? So what I'm saying basically is that the concept of reparations is beginning to resonate even outside, way beyond the Caribbean region, way beyond the Americas. And not only with Raul Castro's speech, significant of a few days ago, but also the regional bodies throughout the Americas, the CELAC, for example, which is sort of the organization that encompasses all of the Latin American nations and all of the Caribbean nations, have unanimously agreed on record to support the Caribbean Reparations Commission's demands, so this is just growing at a tremendous pace. It's amazing.
Let's look at it in the United States for a second. So,
right.
One of the issues that keeps coming up, and when issues of reparations is raised, is y'all are just talking about a check.
Right. I know. And it's, that is so far from the way that the argument is being framed today. It is not
frame it for us, then, Doctor.
Yeah, it is absolutely not about handouts or checks to individuals. And that's even been recognized. I don't know if you brothers have been following the mayoral campaign in Chicago. It was happening, the elections, I think, is today.
It's today.
Yes, yes. So we'll know the results later tonight. But anyway, a few weeks ago, the city council in Chicago unanimously passed an ordinance calling on the city of Chicago to pay reparations to the communities and the families, mostly African-American families, that have suffered from police torture while they were incarcerated in Chicago. So this, but it was vetoed by Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, and who has veto power over city council ordinances in the city of Chicago. But what was significant is the way this demand was framed. It was framed as a reparations demand for payments of some $20 million, not to individuals or individual families, but to the communities where the brothers and sisters who were tortured lived or came from, you know. So it's a concept, I believe, that is really enjoying a lot of currency around the world, but also here in the United States.
But what would it mean for African Americans? I mean, a number of years ago, I had this exchange with an African American activist who is in opposition to reparations as a, mm-hmm. as a strategic direction, and part of what he raised with me was the idea that, well, it's one thing for a government,
mm-hmm.
as you mentioned, you know, the government of Jamaica or Trinidad
States.
Or whatever,
mm-hmm.
right, right, to demand reparations from another power.
Right.
For better or for worse, we don't have a government for Black America.
Right.
So the question then is, well, what does it look like?
Well, that's to be determined, Bill, and that's what the newly formed African American Reparations Commission is charged to do in these series of town hall meetings that will be coming up over the next several months with input from the community. What would a program or a plan for reparations within the African American context look like? You know, and so there's no blueprint for it yet. There may be some precedents, there may be examples like what's happening in the Caribbean region, like the reparations that have been paid to the Jewish people and to the State of Israel by Germany right after World War II. I mean, there are lots of precedents. The reparations that were paid to the victims of torture during the British imperialist struggle against the Mau Mau in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was a successful case that was won a couple of years ago in the British courts, and the British government had to pay the descendants of those who were tortured in Kenya several hundred million pounds. So, I mean, there are different variables. There is no cookie cutter type approach to this. So, you know, it's left to be seen what this commission will come up with, let's say, at the end of this year.
Why should other communities give a damn?
You mean outside of the African-American community?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's fundamentally a question of racial justice, social justice. It's a moral issue more than anything else. America has never come to grips with the original sin of slavery. Still hasn't. There has never been even an apology from the President of the United States to its African American citizens. You know, the Congress passed a resolution some years ago, and also several states at the state level apologizing for lynchings. You know, so that's on public record. But there's never been an apology from the highest office in the land in the United States for its original sin of slavery, and so that reckoning still has to be done. And I think that, you know, what Ta-Nehisi Coates did with his piece in The Atlantic and the response, the public response, particularly on the part of young African-Americans, young activists. I'm now hearing that, you know, some of the leadership of the Black Lives Matter movement are beginning to become very interested in this concept of reparations. So I think that this is a debate that is going to continue. In fact, it is going to pick up momentum coming out of this conference in New York, and I think it's a very healthy thing for the country as a whole.
It seems. Well, see, here's the question: can you have a discussion? Is reparations? Is a discussion of reparations a discussion that can happen before there is a discussion about race in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. I think a discussion on reparations will force a discussion and a debate on race that has been promised by several administrations, going back to the Clinton administration, and never really happened. And even under the Obama administration, there's never been a serious effort to mount a national conversation on race and racism. But if this reparations idea continues to gather momentum, I think it will force that issue onto the table. And it'll be difficult to avoid it. I mean, you can't separate reparations from a discussion on race and racism and white supremacy. You know, they're all intertwined. Yeah, so I think what's going to happen over the next several months is going to be well worth watching carefully. How this conference plays out across the country, how it ramifies across the country and across the world, what next steps the Caribbean countries will take. They have already said that if the European powers do not seriously sit down and begin a process of negotiating reparations with them, that they're going to take the issue to the International Court of Justice at The Hague. You know, so there are all kinds of ramifications that can arise in the months ahead.
Just seems to me that one of the things, Don, that has to be different this time,
mm-hmm.
when the issue of reparations come up, there's a certain discussion that takes place within Black America, but then there's a discussion that's broader,
right,
that tends to, if not ridicule it, dismiss it, claiming that the anti-poverty programs of the
right.
60s and 70s were reparations, that there have been plenty of programs that have been offered,
mm-hmm.
and that here we are again coming hat in hand, and there will be Black folks
yep.
that will be, arguing this thing, and I'm sure people like the probable presidential candidate Ben Carson
right.
would be dismissing this
right.
right as you know, here goes the Negroes asking for a handout again
right.
And so the question I want to push this issue about
mm-hmm.
the issue, the discussion of race,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, can do we, in order to have a successful discussion of reparations, don't we really have to force this country to really look at its own history and
Absolutely.
To look at the way race has been constructed?
Absolutely. Well, you know, a number of developments, recent developments, sort of pushing the discussion in that direction. The report that was released a week or two ago that demonstrated and actually put numbers to the amounts of lynchings that took place in the South over the last century, has received a lot of attention and has prompted a considerable debate. I think that's one thing. The reparations issue is even now coming onto the radar of mainstream media. Just last Sunday on ABC with Stephanopoulos, that Sunday morning program that he does, he had on a debate between Shelby Steele, you know, the well-known neocon African-American scholar, and Ta-Nehisi Coates just this past Sunday. And it was all about reparations. You know, I think I saw the piece. I thought that Coates did a fine job, and Shelby Steele was his arguments were shallow and in some cases just downright irrational. You know, but this is getting onto the radar now of mainstream media. Now, once mainstream media picks up on this, I think it's going to start to begin to be taken seriously in the upcoming elections campaigns. I know that you know, several of the networks have already reached out to us at the Institute of the Black World. NBC is interested in covering the conference in New York, the Huffington Post, CBS, and so on. So you know, it might just spark some coverage in mainstream media, which will then resonate across public opinion generally. So we'll see how things develop.
Now, in addition to the commission,
yes,
is there an organizing program?
There is the beginnings of an organizing program that we are sketching out, and we are going to be presenting. We, meaning the Institute of the Black World, will be presenting to the delegates at the conference in New York for their consideration. But nothing has been finalized. As I said, this process of taking the discussions from New York across the country in town hall style meetings with community residents is going to be critical to the formulation of a program and a plan of action moving forward.
Folks, our phone number 866-99-SERIOUS, 866-997-4748 to join our conversation on this topic. Let me just say, you know, at the beginning of this, in terms of what I was saying, and Brother Bill and Don know this about me, you know, some of us have been involved in this reparation struggle for quite some time, and I was on one of the Ancobra litigation commissions myself, and so when I was saying some folk aren't ready for it, well, part of that, you all forgive me, is because of my own PTSD. Because, no, really, and Bill alluded to, when you bring this up,
right,
some folks start acting out of control, you know.
That's right.
It's still, you know, it's really, it's probably, you know, the third rail issue,
yeah,
when we,
yeah,
talk about race. Because,
right,
folk, it's interesting, and it shows you how personal race can be. When you start talking about reparations, some folk literally start thinking about specific money leaving their personal pocket.
Right.
And, you know, and they trip about it.
Right.
So
right.
I'm always bracing myself for that topic. But one of the things that we're going to do and that we're working on, because this is historically unprecedented, that you have governments now,
right,
that are calling for this. And kudos to you, Don, and Dr. Daniels and others for working on this. It is our goal and our intention to bring you much of this summit, the public parts of it,
right,
live here on this broadcast.
That would be wonderful.
So you all in the audience will hear this. I mean, we're not going to shy away from it, but I want you to be aware that this is coming down the pike. So we're working on that, first of all. And second of all, we invite all of you to join our conversation. And if you two would permit me, just kind of tie this up into Black History Month and everything that's going on currently.
Mm-hmm.
You all also know next week we'll be in Selma. We'll be broadcasting from Selma, our annual,
right,
broadcast from Selma.
Right.
And some of you in the audience may have tired of me saying it, but I just want to tie all these strings together. In the movie, which is very important, they chronicle Malcolm's visit to Selma.
Mm-hmm.
We celebrated the anniversary of his martyrdom over the weekend. And when he went to Selma, one of the overtures that he made to Dr. King was to ask Dr. King to join him in petitioning the United Nations on behalf of African Americans. So it is very timely when we talk about an internationalist, pan-Africanist conference on reparations that is continuing what Malcolm talked about. In fact, the three of us have a mentor, Don, Bill, and I, in the person of ancestor John Henry Clark, and one of his favorite words was continuum. And so that's what this is. Marcus Garvey, League of Nations.
Right.
Malcolm X, United Nations. Now this is real. You have countries from around the world, the Caribbean world, coming together in a self-determined fashion to talk about justice for African people. So this is timely and important, and we welcome it. Folks, we invite you to go to IBW21.org to find out more. Bill Fletcher Jr., Don Rojas with us. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back.
Cut that one off. That's from 1930, back when Roosevelt was running around. So we're going to get another one on here from the great Mitzi Miller. We're celebrating today, celebrating the great happening that's going to be happening with the Black Boys. Yeah. Boy, that's a good one. That's a good one. I remember back in the day when we used to watch Mitch Miller on television. And I loved that music. Yeah, and we're celebrating here. I haven't had a drink yet, but boy, I'm telling you, later on I'm going to, because the blacks are just dealing us a pat hand. Yeah, they're dealing us a pat hand. You know, before when they were just sort of tongue-in-cheek about it, it didn't make too much difference. But that was about 25 years ago, maybe more. I went to a couple of their meetings and supported it, because my position is that we should give the Negroes billions of dollars, take it from the elites, and then once the Negroes got it in their hands, then the white working class take it from the blacks. I thought that was a pretty good plan. But back in the day, it wasn't talked seriously. Now it's serious. This is serious. They're going to all the nations of the Caribbean, to the European nations, anywhere where there's blacks and mixed breeds and all that, and they're getting them all together for a Camp of the Saints situation. Man, they want the money. And nothing can scare the shit out of the white elite and the white population more than they want your money, man. If they want to take your life, well, they'll only get a few. But boy, they want to take all your money, man. Guess what that's going to cause? And if they get a head of steam on this thing, at least they'll be. If they don't get what they want, they'll be rioting worldwide. Yeah, rioting in the Caribbean, rioting in the United States, rioting England, France, and all these colonial nations. So when your opposition deals you a pat hand, you better take it, because you may not get another chance, Whitey. Well, since we're on a roll today, I think I'm going to play you another excerpt from a book. I don't want to run this in the ground, but this is about the Civil War and why. What led up to the Civil War? That's what's important. And at what points could they have backed off and got out of it and not gone into it? Several places, several times they could have. And finally, Lincoln did the ultimate sin, and which he could have not done, and kicked it off. And so here we go on that.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. The Civil War, the Second American Revolution, the catastrophe of the Civil War. We all now reflect back upon those events, the violence, the mass deaths of Americans on North and South, and the resulting turmoil and beggaring of the nation for some decades afterwards. Perhaps not until the 20th century did the South recover. However, there was a moment before the guns fired, a moment before Fort Sumter, between the election of Abraham Lincoln of Illinois and his inauguration in March. That was the inauguration in before the 20th century, in March of 1861, and then the firing of Fort Sumter in April. In those 5 months, many voices, strong voices, compromising voices, worked to stop what they saw was an inevitable conflict between the North and the South, an armed conflict. And there is an exciting new book that covers this period without guns being fired. And yet you all know that what was about to happen was in the minds of these men. These are the leading politicians and officer class of the moment that goes into the catastrophe itself. The new book is We Have the War Upon Us. It is the onset of the Civil War, November 1860 to April 1861. William J. Cooper is the author, Professor Cooper is the Boyd Professor at Louisiana State University and the past president of the Southern Historical Association. Professor, a very good evening to you. Congratulations. I take you to a dramatic moment in your book. This is December 20th, 1860, in Illinois, in Abraham Lincoln's house. He is president-elect of the United States. In attendance of this meeting are two of Mr. Lincoln's kitchen cabinets, David Davis and Leonard Swett, but they are greeting and welcoming a messenger, a man from the North, who is very prominent in the newborn Republican Party. His name is Thurlow Weed. He's an editor from New York. Who is Mr. Weed, and what is his mission to the president-elect at this moment? Good evening to you, Professor.
Good evening to you. Thurlow Weed was a major figure in New York State in the New York Republican Party. He had been before in the Whig Party. He was not an office holder. He was an organizer. He was a wire puller. He was a manipulator. He was very, very close to William Henry Seward, who was a major Republican office holder in New York State. Seward, as a Whig, had been a governor. Now he was a senior United States senator from the state. He was looked upon as a leading Republican figure. In fact, most Republicans looked upon him as a major Republican figure because the president-elect, Abraham Lincoln, was largely unknown. What he would do was unknown at that time. And after Lincoln's election in November, a sectional crisis erupted. There was talk of secession. The southern states began to plan to go out of the Union. Congress met in the very beginning of December, and there was all sorts of talk about what would happen. And there were people who also said, we've got to try to do something to stave off this crisis. And there were even Republicans who said, the South is alarmed. We must try to do something to decrease that alarm. Weed himself proposed in his newspaper, which was in Albany, New York, that the Republican Party adopt a compromise on the basic issue dividing the two sides, the territories. The Southerners thought they should be allowed to go to the territories with slave property if they chose. Republicans said no. Weed said, let's hark back to the American tradition of territorial compromise, which goes way back, and let's just adopt a new territorial compromise now in 1860. Now, Seward's name was not on the proposal in Weed's newspaper, but Weed and Seward were so close. They collaborated so closely, there can be no doubt that Seward was aware of what Weed was doing. Weed and Seward were also very concerned about Lincoln's cabinet. They wanted to be composed totally of old conservative Whigs, as Seward identified himself. So when Weed went out to Springfield, he went hoping he could get Lincoln to commit to the kind of cabinet that he and Seward wanted, and hoping he could get Lincoln to agree to some kind of territorial compromise.
Territorial compromise. They're proposing to the president-elect that he endorse now a territorial compromise extending the Missouri Compromise line that had been worked out in 1850 by such as Clay of Kentucky. And what we're looking at here is a conversation. It is simultaneously the same day that South Carolina goes out, the first state to go out of the slave states, or declares itself seceding from the Union. Is that crisis in Mr. Lincoln's mind and Mr. Weed's mind during this conversation?
Well, they didn't know right at that moment on the 20th that South Carolina was going out, but Seward had told Weed that he was sure South Carolina would go out.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln had all sorts of information coming to him. The future of South Carolina, I think most informed people believed South Carolina would leave the Union. So though they didn't know for a fact, I think they both assumed.
We have to flag that in the minds of Mr. Lincoln, Mr. Weed, Mr. Seward, is that South Carolina leaving the Union wouldn't be the first time. They could both reflect back to Andrew Jackson and the nullification crisis of 1832 and other threats to leave the Union since then. And South Carolina had not been successful with President Jackson, so it leaving the Union by itself was not going to overwhelm the country. Is that a fair assumption in the minds of Mr. Weed and Mr. Lincoln at this time?
I would think they thought South Carolina alone would not, but South Carolina, of course, back in the nullification crisis, didn't actually leave the Union. They tried to stay in the Union and nullify, that is to say they wouldn't obey the law, but that was worked out with a compromise. But everybody feared, most people feared that if South Carolina went, that it would only be the first state, that others would go too,
mm-hmm.
unless something were done to stop the movement towards secession.
Did Mr. Lincoln give his opinion to Mr. Weed to carry back to Mr. Seward at this meeting?
Well, he certainly gave his opinion to Weed, but it was not so much direct as indirect. He told Weed that the cabinet hadn't been decided upon, but he would do the deciding. He made no commitments on the cabinet. And on territorial compromise, he didn't give Weed what he wanted. And when Weed left Springfield, he went back to New York State, and Seward, who lived out in the western part of the state, boarded the train. They rode together to Albany. And on that ride, Weed let Seward know that, one, the cabinet was probably not going to be to their liking, and, two, that Lincoln was obdurate on the territorial question, at least at that point.
We are now at the moment of December 20th. This is South Carolina's out. We need to review the previous month since the election, because in there is the compromise that may have worked. We're looking at what-if history, but we're also looking at the tensions in a country that's being pulled apart by extremists, called radicals at the time, on both sides. Mr. Seward is the leader of the compromisers of the Republican Party, which is itself an expression of the radicals, the abolitionists of the North. The Republican Party is entirely northern. We will go back to what the professor points to. December 3rd, the organizing of the last session of Congress. Just a note here, President Buchanan is in control of the government and will be until March 4th. When Congress met on December 3rd, what was President Buchanan's opinion that he sent to Congress? What was his attitude towards compromise?
Well, Buchanan was distraught. He was very divided. His cabinet, made up of Northerners and Southerners, was divided. Buchanan said we needed to make a compromise. He wanted to somehow compromise the territorial question between the Southerners and the Republicans. But Buchanan, at laying out the problem, saying we need to have a compromise, he made some very good points, but then he launched into an impassioned attack on the Republican Party, which guaranteed that he could get no Republicans to support him. So Buchanan, his message to the Congress really didn't please anybody, because among other things he said that secession was unconstitutional, which the Southerners didn't like, but he also said if secession occurred, there was nothing he could do about it. So nobody really liked what he had to say. And on the compromise question, he said we should do it, but then when he lambasted the Republicans, it sort of guaranteed that he would get no support from Republicans, even those who were compromise-minded.
The book is We Have the War Upon Us, The Onset of the Civil War, November 1860, the election of Abraham Lincoln, to April of 1861, the opening fire on Fort Sumter. William J. Cooper is the author. When we come back, that last congressional session, the last chance to stop the catastrophe, starting December 3rd. Who were the compromisers? How did the House and the Senate approach this crisis? I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor William J. Cooper is here. His new book is We Have the War Upon Us, The Onset of the Civil War, November 1860, April 1861. There is no whiff of gunpowder in the professor's book. However, there are plenty of loud voices, the very men who will, say, open fire at the battlefields of 1861 through the catastrophe and the decimation of the country, 1865, and then the long recovery and reconstruction afterwards. This is a moment when Congress had a chance, December 3rd, 1861, the organizing of the last session. In those days, Congress would come back after an election and sit until the day of the inauguration, which was now March 3rd, early March of 1861. And in that session, the Congress, the old Congress, is sitting. Professor, first with the House, William Pennington is the Speaker. He chooses a committee of 33. Who were they, and what was the intent of that committee?
Well, the committee of 33 was, the number 33 came from the decision to have one member from every state. And this committee was charged to look into the crisis of the Union and try to come up with a proposal to present to the full House. Pennington appointed the committee. He tried to divide it according to the partisan divide in the House. The House was very closely divided. He appointed Republicans and Democrats, but what he did in appointing Democrats, He didn't appoint any Northern Democrats except those from California and Oregon. He did that because they didn't have any other congressmen. They were only Democrats from those two states. But the rest of the Democrats were Southerners. This angered Northern Democrats. The Northern Democrats were amongst the strongest proponents of some kind of sectional compromise. Now, amongst the Republicans on the committee, the Republicans on the committee were like the Republican Party in general. There were those who were interested in compromise, there were those who were adamantly opposed to compromise, and there was a group in the middle that would go whichever way they thought leadership wanted them to go. They were willing to wait and listen. They didn't want to commit themselves. On the Democratic side, most of them were Southerners, and the Southerners on the committee, those from the Deep South, the so-called Cotton States, most of them were adamantly for secession. They were the counterparts of the stalwart Republicans. They wanted their states to go out. In fact, two of them didn't even want to serve on the committee because they were committed to secession. But the committee gets underway right away. On the Senate side, there's a proposal for committee, but it takes a bit longer for the Senate to get its committee appointed. It comes somewhat later.
The committee of 13. Now,
that's correct.
Now, what they're discussing, these two committees, and we have resonance of this today. Whenever the Senate is divided or the House is divided, there are committees that come forward to argue this behind doors or in a way that they can take to the whole body. Right now, they're again dealing with the question of slavery in the new territories. But no one, if I follow you correctly, no one in the House or the Senate, not the President-elect, not Stephen A. Douglas, and we'll speak of him in a moment, no one is suggesting that the Constitution will permit abolishing slavery in the states. Is that correct, Professor?
Oh, no, no. The only people who thought about abolishing slavery in the state were extraordinarily extremist. Republicans... There were practically no Republicans who believed that. Certainly Lincoln didn't. Certainly no major Republican politician did.
Which is why they're arguing about the territories, because that's outside
correct. Well,
of the
Constitution. They're arguing about a couple other things, too. They're arguing about fugitive slaves, that is, those slaves who escaped from the slave states to get to the free states. There are a couple of other things they're arguing about.
And the powers of states to organize with a vote whether they're going to be slave or free. They're also arguing about that.
Yes, well, that has to do with the territories. The territorial question, which, of course, has to do with the future of the country. What's the country going to look like in the future? That's what the territorial issue is all about. It's about power. It's about a sense of what America is to be.
There are very strong voices that are not called Democrats or Republicans or Whigs at this time. They're called by metaphorical names. Professor, who are the Fire Eaters? What does that represent?
The Fire Eaters are the radical Southerners, those who want secession, those who do not want any kind of compromise, those who want the Union ended immediately and even before immediately if possible. They believe that the Union is a dagger poised at the Southern heart, and if the South stays in the Union, that the South and its slave institution, the two of them are doomed. And they want to do nothing but push for secession. And they press regular politicians on that issue.
You name Lewis T. Wigfall. I love his name. From Texas.
He was a senator from Texas. Probably the most famous, two most famous radicals were a newspaper man in South Carolina by the name of Robert Barnwell Rhett and a politician in Alabama by the name of William Lowndes Yancey. But Wigfall was a senator, and there were other Fire Eaters who were in the Congress.
If this government does not suit us, we will leave it. Let's go to Rhett. You mentioned him. He's an editor, the son of a very famous senator from South Carolina. He's the editor in Charleston. What is Mr. Rhett's preference now as we approach the decision in South Carolina? He advocates that. Does he advocate the rest of the South to just leave the Union?
Yeah. The two Rhetts, they're both named Robert Barnwell Rhett. One is Junior. The one had been the editor of the paper. Junior in 1860 was the editor, but his father was very involved with it. They believe that if they can get South Carolina out, that somebody else will follow, that they have to get momentum. And if South Carolina sits and waits, nothing is going to happen. But if South Carolina will act, then somebody else will follow.
Now, on the northern side, I think there's a rough equivalent to Mr. Rhett. That would be Horace Greeley of the Tribune in New York. He is also adamant that the North must force the South to obey. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, Greeley starts off by saying that he's the editor of the New York Tribune, which is the most well-known Republican paper, the most widely distributed Republican paper. Greeley starts off by saying, let secession occur, let them go away.
Right.
But he changes his mind pretty quickly and says, we can't let them go away. But Greeley is on the hardline side of the Republican Party, and there are a number of people over there with him.
Let's talk about the opposite of the fire eaters, of the abolitionists. Now, they are they're a long tradition in the North, but it's important that they dominate the Senate. At this point, Salmon Chase of Ohio or William Pitt Fessenden of Maine, are they considered conservatives or radicals in the Republican Party of December of 1860?
Well, they would be on the radical side, but they're not abolitionists. They don't believe that slavery can be ended by... slavery is protected by the Constitution, but they are adamant that there be no more slave territory, and they're adamant that the Republican Party does not compromise on the territorial question. And they're very much anti-South. They want to curb what they see as the South has been too powerful, they think, in the Congress, and they want to curb that power. But they're not abolitionists, because abolitionists believe in the immediate uncompensated emancipation of all slaves.
Right.
Neither Chase nor Fessenden is there.
Which is extra-constitutional in the understanding at this moment.
That's correct.
And the South wants guarantees that that will never happen. They want constitutional guarantees, and we'll turn to that in a moment. But one more note here. Men such as Hale of New Hampshire, you mention him prominently. He's like the opposite of Wigfall of Texas, wouldn't
you say? That's correct, yes.
And Hale's voice is very strong, almost drowns out Seward many instances in the newspapers.
Well, Hale and there are others like Hale. They are very articulate. They don't hesitate to say what they think. And they put a great deal of rhetorical and political pressure on more moderate Republicans.
The book is We Have the War Upon Us, The Onset of the Civil War, November 1860 to April 1861. William J. Cooper is the author. When we come back, a convention called at the time mockingly a concession convention, February 1861, Washington, D.C. Who attends? What happens? I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. It's a pleasure to speak to Professor William J. Cooper. His new book is We Have the War Upon Us, The Onset of the Civil War, November 1860, April 1861. And what you chiefly learn from the professor's book is that the men who are about to do homicide to each other, to their brethren, to their sons, and tear the country not only in half, but chew it up for decades afterwards. And there are echoes of this crisis still here in the 21st century. They all knew each other. They were very well informed. And the strongest power at the moment before the guns fired was compromise. Mr. Seward of New York is the lead compromiser in the Republican Party. But there are other voices. Professor, the February 1861 convention, peace convention, it called itself, gathering next to the Willard Hotel. The Willard Hotel stands in Washington today. There was a lobby or a building right next door where they gathered. It was to be led by former President John Tyler, and he had an audience with the President, James Buchanan. What did Mr. Tyler hope to accomplish with Mr. Buchanan at the beginning of the peace convention?
Well, he wanted Buchanan to support the efforts of the peace convention, which, of course, Buchanan was happy to do. Buchanan was within 2 to 3 weeks of leaving office. He desperately hoped that nothing would come for a conflict to begin before he left office. So he was eager to support anybody who was trying to stave off conflict. And he realized that he wasn't able to do it. He couldn't get any place with Congress. He was not making any significant headway toward solving the problem, and he hoped the peace convention could, and that he and Tyler agreed on that.
The peace convention gathers not all northern states, not all southern states send delegates to this, but a significant number do, and there's an effort to gather the former presidents who are still alive, Millard Fillmore, Frederick Pierce, even Martin Van Buren, indicates he might come to Washington. They're looking to come up with some organization that can overwhelm or outweigh or delay the passion in the South for secession at this point in February. I think Texas goes out on February 1st, so all of the lower South are out, but the upper South, especially Virginia, are still hesitating at this point. Are they listening to the peace convention? Is that well regarded from the Southern point of view?
Well, it certainly is very well regarded from the 8 slave states who hadn't seceded. Now, the Deep South, the Confederate States of America, was being formed at the very same time. They had no interest in the peace convention. And many of them were very concerned about what they feared they call Reconstruction. We think of Reconstruction as coming after the war. But before the war actually broke out, the word Reconstruction was used to bring those states back in the Union. And they didn't want any kind of deal that would perhaps end up with the Confederacy giving up quickly and coming back into the Union. But the 8 slave states that hadn't seceded were very eager for a settlement. Again, Northern Democrats were eager for a settlement. Most Republicans were not. Lincoln had made his position on that very clear. And Seward, though Seward wanted to make a compromise, Seward would never step in front of Lincoln. He supported Lincoln. He never got out in front of Lincoln. He remained a stalwart supporter of Lincoln, and he was loyal to Lincoln. Seward hoped that the peace convention might do something, but I think by this time Seward was becoming dubious.
We can anticipate the conflict in the gathering of the peace convention. I read from the professor that former President John Tyler visited with Buchanan, and they identify the concerns of especially the Virginia delegation or the Virginians who are watching the peace convention, that the North is going to reinforce forts that are in the South. Now, we know of Fort Sumter. We will talk of that. But there's another fort, Fort Pickens at Pensacola. There are other two forts in the Florida Keys. They're also very concerned that the president is sending the warship Brooklyn with troops for Charleston Harbor, and that the guns of Fort Monroe have been turned landward, that is, at Virginia. The President Buchanan has a peculiar understanding, to my mind, Professor, of his powers as president this time. He believes he can defend the Union, but he doesn't believe he can take proactive,
that he can invade
the South with troops or interrupt
right.
in any fashion.
He said he will only act in defense. He will only shoot guns in defense, because what Buchanan wants most to avoid is civil war. And he says only the other side can start it. He will take no offensive action whatever. Now, he does take offensive action early January when they sent a ship down to reinforce Fort Sumter, but that was a fiasco. It didn't work out, and after that, he determined he was going to do nothing to reinforce Fort Sumter or to reinforce Fort Pickens unless the federal commanders asked for help. And then he said if they asked for help to defend themselves, he would send help. But he didn't want them to start shooting at all.
There are moments in February of 1861 that very much read like an opera. One particular, there's a levee at the White House on February 12th, which is described as very brilliant, the president entertaining the peace commissioners, who are denounced in the South as the concession commissioners and denounced in the denounced in the North as the concession conventioners and denounced in the South as traitors to the cause. But on the one that I wish to attend, Professor, is Mrs. Douglas gives a ball on February 13th that has a very large attendance, and including Julia Tyler, the young wife of the former president. We must speak of Stephen Douglas. He is a man who represents a compromise. Did he have a strong voice at this point in February during the peace convention?
Yeah, well, Douglas was a senator from Illinois. He was a Democrat. He had run for president in 1860 as a candidate of the northern wing of the Democratic Party. Of course, he lost. But Douglas had a powerful following in the North. Douglas was a very influential senator, and Douglas exerted every effort he could to stave off conflict, to support compromise, some sort of compromise that would have staved off conflict. But, of course, Douglas didn't succeed.
Douglas failed, and yet he was going back and forth between Lincoln, whom he knew very well for a long time. They debated, but before that, their families had been all mixed up. I think there is a romantic story that Mary Lincoln might have married Stephen Douglas at one point.
I don't think so much of that one.
I've always liked it, anyway.
Douglas for a long time. They'd been rising stars in Illinois politics for a long time.
And Douglas is a voice of compromise as well. And so when I look at this drama in February of 1861, reading the remarks of everyone who are always being produced in the newspaper, it's as if the radicals on both sides fear Douglas, fear Seward, fear the peace convention much more than they fear war. Is that a fair generalization?
Yes, but I don't think they see in those terms. They don't necessarily know that war is coming. They fear compromise. They fear the Republicans don't want, many Republicans don't want a deal because they think it will help the South and hurt their party. The radical Southerners, and of course by now they're Confederates, they don't want any kind of deal because they hope the other slave states will come and join them. And if there's a really successful compromise, they fear that somehow in time Reconstruction, that is the bringing of those states back in the Union, might take place. And so the people who don't want, who won't compromise, have very powerful forces arrayed against them. Ideology, partisan politics, and of course the main thing is President-elect Lincoln simply says, no, we're not going to do it.
Yes, Lincoln becomes more and more anti-slavery in his statements, having been an admirer of Clay during the bulk of his campaigning for the presidency, and a man who was chosen over Seward, if I follow correctly, Professor, because he was considered more conservative than Seward in June of 1860, a man from the West.
He was considered more conservative than Seward, but Lincoln, I don't think, was making any increasingly strident anti-slavery statements in the secession winter. He had always been a fairly strong anti-slavery person, but never in any stretch of the imagination an abolitionist. But Lincoln was very strong about no compromise, and there's several reasons for that, I think. But he was very strong, and he really never wavered on that.
The simultaneous convention in Montgomery, Alabama, a very small town, even of the period, 9,000 people, half of them slaves, and gathering there to form the Confederate States of America out of nothing, are very strong voices. I believe Robert Barnwell Rhett, is in attendance of this. Oh, so is Alexander Stevens of Alabama, of Georgia, who will become the vice president. They're looking to elect a president at this time. Why do they, for the Confederate States of America, why do they choose Jefferson Davis? What attracts them?
Well, I think that Davis had a series of qualifications that nobody else available had. He had a military background. He had been to West Point. He'd been an officer in the regular army, and during the war with Mexico, in the late 1840s, he had been a very successful regimental commander. In fact, he became a military hero. Then he served as Secretary of War in Franklin Pierce's cabinet, a very successful Secretary of War. On top of that, he was a major political figure. No Southerner in the Congress had more influence than Davis did at the end of the decade. On top of that, Davis was looked upon as a very moderate conservative man. He was not a fire eater. He had not wanted secession to occur. So nobody else had that combination of qualities that could match what he had.
Davis is chosen by vote very quickly. You say that a whole thing takes a half an hour, the vote in Montgomery. Does that have the weight of all the slave states, or is this aspirational on their part, that they can vote a president and everybody will obey him?
Well, he's elected as the provisional president by the states in Montgomery. There will be a presidential election in November of 1861. Nobody really thinks about that. And in fact, the Confederate states still hold an election that time, but the war was on and Davis had no opposition. If the war hadn't come, Davis would have probably had opposition in that election. He was a provisional president in Montgomery, and of course they hoped that they could bring in the rest of the slave states. That's what they hoped they could do.
Right. They're looking for a provocation and something to hang their organizing skills upon, because right now, if I read you correctly, a professor, delay is the enemy of the Confederate States of America, and delay, Seward argues, is the strength of the northern position. Draw this out. Don't let it come to a crisis. One other thing happens in February. All these things are happening simultaneously in a time where newspapers and letters traveled overland. It could take some weeks. Lincoln leaves Springfield February 11th, and he doesn't arrive in Washington until February 23rd. In his remarks traveling east to prepare for the inauguration early March, is he making statements that can be read as concessions by the southern states that haven't withdrawn yet?
No, he really doesn't. His remarks are in many ways disjointed. He talks about that there's not really a serious crisis, and then he says he's going to take a stern hand. When he gets to Washington itself, he makes a couple of brief speeches in which he talks about friendship to the South. And so it's not really clear what Lincoln is, clear themes in his remarks, except he does continually say that he will uphold the law. And that he continually says that he is the president of the entire United States. He says that secession is not legal, not constitutional. But where Lincoln is going to stand and exactly what he's going to do, it's not at all clear.
And that lack of clarity has to be filled in by events coming after the inauguration in March. And when we come back, the very first day in office, Lincoln has upon him the crisis, and it will come down to the specifics of Fort Pickens of Pensacola, Florida, or Fort Sumter of Charleston, South Carolina. The book is We Have the War Upon Us, The Onset of the Civil War, November 1862, April 1861. William J. Cooper is the author. I'm John Batchelor. John Batchelor Show. Professor William J. Cooper's book, We Have the War Upon Us, is the story of the last 5 months before the catastrophe of the Civil War and the outbreak, the firing of weapons, in Charleston Harbor at Fort Sumter. This is all, however, an arranged landscape because both the radicals of the North and the South are looking for an event to say, that's it, we're broken now, we're going to organize. And I learned from the professor that on Mr. Lincoln's first day in office, this is after the inauguration, after the celebration, early March, March 3rd, March 4th, Winfield Scott, who's the general of the army, comes to Mr. Lincoln to present to him what looks to be the critical moment of Fort Sumter, reinforcement of Fort Sumter or not. Professor, did Lincoln anticipate Sumter, and did Scott arrive in front of Lincoln in a surprise fashion, the new president, now president sworn in? Did he know Sumter was the crisis upon him?
Well, Lincoln knew that Sumter was a volatile place, but all the evidence indicates that when Lincoln took the oath of office and became president, he intended to follow the policy of Buchanan, which was sort of we live and let live. There was a federal garrison at Fort Sumter. There was no shooting. It had been like that for months, and Lincoln would probably thought we'll just continue that. But the day after he was inaugurated, he was visited by Buchanan's last Secretary of War, who brought him a message that they had received the day before, the actual date of Lincoln's inauguration, from the federal commander at Fort Sumter, saying that his supplies were running out and that within 6 weeks, if he didn't receive new supplies, he would have to leave. He would be starved out.
This is Major Anderson, who'd arrived.
Major Robert Anderson,
yes,
that's correct.
November of 1860, he'd been sent there. Please continue.
Well, this message, and this was an absolute shock. Nobody expected this at all. The Buchanan people didn't expect this because Anderson's messages to Washington prior to this time had all said that things were fine, he was doing okay. But now comes this message that he's running out of supplies, and then he's got a second point. He says that the Confederate works around Fort Sumter, and Fort Sumter sits in the middle of Charleston Harbor. It's on a man-made island, that the Confederate works around it have become so strong that he didn't think it was possible that he'd be reinforced except by a massive naval and army force much larger than the existing military in the United States at that time. And this was an absolute shock as well. And President Lincoln then asked the General-in-Chief of the Army, Winfield Scott, did he agree? And Scott said, yes, I agree that we can't do it with what we've got. The Chief Engineer of the Army agreed. And so Lincoln was now faced with a terrible quandary. What do I do? Do I withdraw Major Anderson, or do I try to reinforce him or do something to keep him there?
You write,
even though my general tells me I can't do it.
You write that General Scott was rehearsed by Mr. Seward, who is now Secretary of State. What did Seward want Lincoln to do through Scott?
Well, Seward and Scott worked very closely in tandem. Seward very much wanted Lincoln to withdraw from Fort Sumter. Just like he wanted Lincoln to make a compromise before the war, he wanted Lincoln to withdraw from Fort Sumter because Seward wanted very much to avoid a conflict. He feared that a conflict, the outbreak of war, would take all the other slave states into the Confederate states, would make Reconstruction or reunion practically impossible, would lead to a horrible war, and nobody knew what would happen in terms of that war. So he was pressing Lincoln to pull out of Fort Sumter. And he said, you know, it's not our fault. You cannot let this situation get out of hand. Politically, we'll take a small hit, but we can handle that. So he was urging Lincoln to withdraw.
And Lincoln now takes steps that are mixed because there are two forts at issue, Fort Pickens of Pensacola, which is a much harder fort for the rebellion to storm because of its physical position, and Fort Sumter, which is right in the harbor and can be fired upon, as we know. Mr. Lincoln goes back and forth about whether to reinforce or not. I want to go to the other side, Jefferson Davis, who's very well informed of all these events. Jefferson Davis writes that he wants peace, but it's a peculiar peace. He wants to be left alone. In other words, he wants the secession to be made a fait accompli by Mr. Lincoln. Does Mr. Davis know that that's impossible at this moment?
I don't know whether you say he knows it's impossible. What the Confederates wanted, they looked upon the flag flying at Fort Sumter and Fort Pickens as a foreign force, military force within their borders, an uninvited
right.
foreign force,
right.
which mocked their independence. They wanted them gone. To say that Davis thought that was impossible, from his point of view, Lincoln could easily have decided to withdraw the forces from Fort Sumter, and if that had happened, left Fort Pickens there, then the Fort Pickens would have been another problem to solve down the road. But from a man like Seward, you put problems, you push down the road, the chances are you can work something out. But Davis was hoping that they would withdraw. But if they didn't withdraw, then if the crunch came, he was certainly not willing to keep the flag flying. And when Lincoln finally decided that he would not withdraw Major Anderson, and in a brilliant decision, he said he would not reinforce, he would simply send supplies and medicine there to bolster the troops who were there to keep them going. Davis had to decide what to do, and Davis decided that he couldn't permit that, because if he permitted that, it would be the almost permanent stationing of foreign forces on his borders, and again, it would make a mockery of the Confederate States.
For 5 months now, the argument has continued, North, South, and the compromisers. The guns fire. Beauregard gives the order to fire on Fort Sumter. At that moment, Professor, and we just have 30 seconds, Mr. Lincoln and Mr. Davis, do they know what's coming when the guns fire? Are they aware of what's been put in train?
Well, I think that they know conflict is coming. I think Davis had a much better sense than Lincoln of how terrible it could be because of his military experience and because of his wide knowledge of the North. Lincoln had practically no knowledge of the South at all. So I think they both knew bullets would fire, but I think Davis had a much better sense of how terrible it was going to be.
We have the war upon us, the onset of the Civil War, November 1860 to April 1861. The guns fire at Fort Sumter. What follows is a catastrophe. William J. Cooper, professor at Louisiana State University. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.
Well, we went a little over there, boys and girls, but I wanted to get those both in there. And I'll tell you, one thing about this that surprised me was Seward's position, who was trying to head off the war and advising Lincoln. And everything I'd always read about Seward, that he was a real bastard and like that. So it sounds like that he wasn't near the bastard he's been described as being. Of course, you know, he was shot the same night and almost died. Same night that Lincoln was shot. So anyhow, that's it for today. Comment on this stuff. I'm trying to give you some education here that I think we all need. A lot of stuff I don't know, too. Okay, that's it. 14:05. I'll be with you tomorrow, Thursday.